Thousands of Floridians owed the state for getting more unemployment than they were due. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. It could be billions. Florida's unemployment system is trying to get back money that it overpaid in benefits during the past year. We'll get the latest from Tallahassee. Also,
addicts come in all forms. It's a disease, just like cancer. It's a disease and it can strike and kill anybody at any time.
There's a system that is supposed to track how people use opioids. It's supposed to help doctors to know who's at risk of abusing, but it may actually be hurting the people who are in need. And finally,
the colors were a little garish, the patterns were a little loud. The whole thing was rebellious, but in a way that was fun.
A Key West artist behind Lily Pulitzer gets her due decades later. All of that today on Sundial after the news. The program is made possible in part by support from Miami Cancer Institute. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thank you so much for joining us. Florida's unemployment agency continues to struggle to right itself. Before, it had issues with allowing people to file claims in a timely manner. Now, it seems the state gave millions, perhaps billions, to people who didn't need it. And now state officials are trying to figure out how to get their money back. Joining us now is Lawrence Maurer, reporter for the Miami Herald and Tampa Bay Times in the Tallahassee Bureau. Lawrence, first of all, I'm curious, how much money is the state trying to get back from people?
Well, frankly, we don't know. And in fact, no one seems to know, including the state. It doesn't seem like they can actually calculate this number. It's a constantly changing number, and it could be anywhere from hundreds of millions of dollars to billions of dollars. One federal report showed that the amount in benefits that were quote unquote overpaid in Florida could be as high as 40%, but really no one knows.
And this is money that was paid out during the past year and a half during the pandemic, right?
That's right. And you know, as a lot of people know, last year it was a total catastrophe with the unemployment system. Connect, the online unemployment system known as Connect, immediately melted down. And that seems to be causing a lot of the problems here. Frankly, we don't even know how much in money people actually have to pay back. A lot of these things go back to the early days of the pandemic. In the first month and a half or so, Florida was in such a rush to get this money out the door that they just, if you applied for benefits, they just sent you money. You know, normally you have to go in and like say, I lost my job on this date, and you got to go in every week and claim benefits for weeks you're not working. Well, in the first month and a half, they just sent all this money out the door and told people months and months later that, hey, you need to go back because we did this. You need to go back. All the recipients need to go back and claim those weeks. Well, a lot of people didn't get that message. A lot of people were unable to log back in. There have been a number of issues logging in with Connect since then. And if you didn't do these things, that would trigger one of these overpayment notices saying, hey, you owe us because, you know, these early first weeks of the pandemic, you didn't go in and claim that you're out of work during those weeks.
So these letters have gone out, and I'm wondering if they don't even know, you know, what's owed. What does the letter say? I mean, what are they telling people? Here's how much you owe us. We don't know. And what's the deadline?
Seriously, it is a total mess. These letters usually have minimal information. They usually just say you owe us this amount of money. You have until this date to appeal, which is usually a couple of weeks. But there's no clarification on the letters about here's why you owe this money or for what period do you owe this money. It does say, hey, you know, some of these letters, they'll keep going out if you don't pay. And they'll say, hey, we're going to send you to collections if you don't pay us back, obviously is a big deal.
Does a person have any way to challenge the claim if they don't, you know, if the state doesn't even know, can't I challenge them?
Yes, you can. You can file an appeal, you know, but what we found is in some of these cases, the letters are sent out after the appeal date. I interviewed a guy last year who was in this situation and he got the letter. I mean, we could prove when it was mailed to his house, when it arrived, and it arrived after the appeal date. So he had no opportunity to appeal. And his issue just seems to have disappeared. It doesn't seem like he does owe money anymore. But, you know, in a lot of these cases, these letters are very threatening. Some I've seen amounts these people will say they owe $18,000, you know, which, of course, if you've been out of work for the past year and a half, you can't pay back. And there are all kinds of other reasons why these letters are going out. But basically, they're a real headache for a lot of people and DEO.
So what should people do? Like, you get one of these letters and it tells you you owe thousands of dollars and you want to dispute it. I mean, where do you go?
Well, you can file an appeal through Connect. You can contact your legislator. But one thing that is important to know is that even though these letters often say that they will send you to collections, that's been suspended.
The governor announced that last week. Yeah.
Yeah, the governor said, because this is such a mess, we're not going to send anyone to collections until, you know, indefinitely, basically. But there's another option, too, which is the federal government earlier this year realized that states, you know, a lot of states are in this situation where they just sent money out the door. The amount of it's caused so many headaches, and they know that there's so many overpayments that if this money is federal money that you owe, you can actually apply for a waiver. The federal government says, look, as long as it's not your fault that we sent you the money, you can just keep it. It's just a way to not deal with any more of these headaches. So there's a few options you can do, but it, you know, going back into Connect right now is not easy. A lot of people have been frustrated by it. So there's no real easy fix, but I would encourage people to contact their local legislator, either in the state house or state senate.
And the other thing too is this, if you're on the list, you owe money, that could be problematic. I mean, later on, if you need benefits, you may not qualify, right?
That's been a big problem. So we've seen people who, once you get triggered with this overpayment notice, you're kind of locked out for a little while, and usually indefinitely until you resolve that somehow, or somehow the state, or sometimes the state will resolve it for you without you even knowing. But yeah, if you say you got your job back and then lost it again and needed to apply for benefits again, you find yourself locked out. I've talked to people who are in this situation too. And so it's just a real headache.
You know, some Floridians have been complaining that they're eligible for benefits, but they've gone weeks without getting any payments. Still part of the problem with the state system. Is any of this been resolved?
It's gotten better. You know, the state, DEO, that's the Department of Economic Opportunity, which runs the unemployment system. They just told lawmakers yesterday that they had about 250,000 claims or so in which people, there were issues with the claims in which the people are waiting to be paid. Obviously, that's way down from earlier in the pandemic when it was like, you know, more than a million people waiting to be paid. But there are still, you know, big problems. I mean, there's about 3.5 million or so adjudication issues. So say you do appeal your overpayment notice, or you've got some kind of hold on your claim for some reason, it's in adjudication. There's 3.5 million of those, basically. It's a number that they keep whittling down, but, you know, people are waiting months to have these things resolved.
This is an ongoing story. What a dilemma. But as you said, the good news is, I mean, if there is a silver lining in this, is that if you get one of these letters, you can challenge it. You can go through Connect. But even as you said, did I hear you right? You know, call your lawmaker if you feel like that's the step to take.
People have found success contacting the lawmaker. The lawmakers have a special portal to DEO, basically, where they can send individual unemployment cases, you know, people who are having issues, to DEO, and DEO can kind of expedite that process. That's been a major thing. Lawmakers have sent like 330,000 or so cases to DEO directly through this portal, and people have had some success through that. You know, I know it's not ideal, but it is a lifeline out there for them.
And just a reminder, if that's the route you're going to take, the legislative session starts in January, and I doubt you're going to get through once they get started. So if you're going to go that route, maybe look at it a little bit earlier. Lawrence Meyer, again, reporter for the Miami Herald and Tampa Bay Times and the Tallahassee Bureau. Find his reporting on this on our social media at WLRN Sundial. Lawrence, always a pleasure.
Thanks, Lewis.
All right, still to come, why the opioid crisis is only getting worse in South Florida. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. We know that deaths from opioid use have gone up during the pandemic. According to the 2020 interim report from the state's medical examiners, deaths caused by opioids are up 51% in Florida compared to the first half of 2019. Illicitly manufactured fentanyl caused the most deaths. The United Way of Broward County is feeling those impacts locally. Kathleen Cannon is the president and CEO. She told WLRN earlier this fall that she wanted to join the new Project Opioid Coalition in Broward because she's seen the job loss, loneliness, and isolation during the pandemic.
We heard so many stories that some people didn't even know that their family member had an addict issue. That's one of the mechanisms that we'll do here. We're going to talk about some of the early warning signs that we can educate families about.
That effort was started in Broward County in August. Someone who knows the effects of overdose personally is Chris Cavallo. He lost one of his daughters, Stephanie, and his wife, Robin, to overdoses about 20 years apart. He's since founded the addiction resource nonprofit, the Robin Foundation, in honor of his wife. WLRN's Katie Switalski-Munoz spoke with Chris recently about his experiences and what he sees the United Way of Broward doing that could be helping people struggling with addiction. And you'll notice, by the way, that Chris has some difficulty speaking. That's due to a vocal cord disorder.
What we see when we look at the state's report on drug deaths is that more and more opioids are being laced with fentanyl. And as a father and a husband, do you think local governments and local agencies are handling opioids and overdoses any better than they did 20 years ago?
I feel like we're just now getting on the bandwagon. I am a recovering addict. Today, I don't know that the answers are any different than they were 30 or 40 years ago. And I guess this is the big difference. 30 or 40 years ago, it was more up to the individual to get the help they needed. But now the community needs to rally around that individual, whether it's the family members or the addict themselves.
People can buy drugs that they don't know are laced with fentanyl. What's your family's experience looking into these cases been like?
My profession as a private investigator, I've had multiple cases brought to me about parents wanting answers that are not getting them. And all of them have to do with either a pill or a powder laced with fentanyl has killed their children.
You know, how were you treated by law enforcement as the family member of someone who's overdosed?
I can only share with you the two instances, my wife who died in Aventura and my daughter Stephanie in Miramar. And in both those cases, and especially with the most recent case with my daughter, Stephanie, when my daughter, Christina, her twin sister, asked, well, what's going to happen now? What's going to be done? Law enforcement's response was, we have so many of these cases, ma'am, and let's be realistic. What could you expect?
So you didn't feel like you were treated with respect by law enforcement when your daughter passed?
Absolutely not. And this is one of my core issues that I believe law enforcement has to be trained. So when a family member arrives on the scene and they're looking at their loved one laying on the floor with either a syringe hanging out of their arm or just dead from an overdose, that they are embraced and not shooed away and not diminished of what they're going through seeing their loved one.
Is there anything that Broward County or law enforcement is doing, any programs or initiatives you see that are working in these communities?
Yes. United Way has sponsored a surveillance committee where business leaders are, in fact, coming together. I'm very proud to be on that committee, and I'm excited about some of the things that they're doing. I was on a call with the Tampa Bay Opioid Surveillance Committee, and they had a guest speaker on from Erie, New York, talking about the distribution of Narcan boxes like kiosks that can be set up in restaurants, fire departments, businesses, where an addict or anyone for that matter can go in and get Narcan and save an addict's life. That's critical.
And I'll just add that Narcan is a shot you can give someone in the event of an overdose that reverses the effects of an overdose.
My Stephanie was saved by Narcan while overdosing under the Davy Bridge. So Narcan does work if they can get there in time. So that's why we have to get it in as many people's hands, whether it's human resource departments where someone's sneaking out at lunchtime, popping open a pill that they don't know is laced with fentanyl, or businesses. We have to embrace getting Narcan out into our community.
The Robin Foundation, can you explain what that is and how you got that started after the death of your wife, Robin?
The Robin Foundation's intent was always to help house women who either had mental illness or addiction problems. During 2007 to 2009, while this country was going through a financial depression, we just couldn't support it any longer. So I was approached right after Stephanie died by my daughter, Christina. And she says, Dad, we have to reinitiate this. When an addict comes in, either through the prison system or from the streets, they need more than just a place to lay their head at night. Many times they have no education or they need job training. So this is part of what the foundation's mission is going to be going forward.
Are there resources for people who have lost family members to overdoses that you wish were more available in this community?
Yes, I wish there was. I wish there was two helplines. One to report dealers who are definitely dealing in this death drug, fentanyl, and opioids. And second, a helpline for family members. What to do if, in fact, they sense that they're children are in trouble. Now, there may be those helplines out there, but I'm not aware of them. And that's scary, okay? Because I'm thinking and going through this on a daily basis. We need to have it on billboards and so everyone is aware of where they can get support.
And the Facebook page you run called Addiction Has No Favorites has become a place where you can share regular videos and remember your family members. How did that get started and what does it mean to you?
We're continually looking for family members to talk to us and tell us what their experience has been. Give them a place to air their, what they've gone through and how were they treated by law enforcement. And again, I come from a law enforcement family. We can't do this without law enforcement. They truly are our most important asset. So we just need them to understand and be able to communicate with people in our community.
You know, how significant do you see the pandemic in this cycle of addiction? Do you know people that are recovering in the South Florida community that have struggled during the pandemic?
Yes, addiction is also a disease of isolation. It's a dark and lonely place to be. I know, I've experienced this, okay? You're ashamed, you're full of guilt, and COVID only made it that much worse.
Chris Cavallo, thank you for sharing your story and your family's story.
Thank you.
Again, that's Chris Cavallo, founder of the addiction resource nonprofit, the Robin Foundation. And as mentioned, he also runs the Facebook page, Addiction Has No Favorites, where people, again, can share their stories and remember loved ones. Chris was speaking with WLRN reporter Katie Switalski-Munoz, who joins us now in studio to keep up this conversation about the opioid crisis. And I also want to bring in Maya Solovitz. She's a freelance journalist and author. Her most recent book is titled Undoing Drugs, The Untold Story of Harm Reduction and the Future of Addiction. Thank you both so much. Katie, to start with you, I mean, this conversation with Chris, really hard to listen to, and you think about what he's lost in his life. What else stood out for you in the conversation that we didn't hear, though?
You know, we talked a couple of times, Lewis, and it was really interesting to me how, you know, Chris is driven by preventing other people from losing what he's lost. And I think it's a matter of he really wants people to understand and show up with compassion at every point that addiction is touched by, right? The medical system, law enforcement, community services, the idea that we need way more of a wraparound approach and just sort of compassion, treating addiction like the disease it is, rather than, you know, something that's someone's doing wrong on purpose.
Maya, you know this story from another perspective. You dealt with addiction for several years when you were younger, teenager. Can you see parts of your story and Chris's story?
Yeah, I mean, addiction, the idea that it's a disease of isolation and social disconnection and just feeling like you just don't connect with anybody, it's a very, very big part of addiction. And oftentimes that's driven by either surviving child trauma, having a pre-existing mental illness, or some other source of despair. Virtually everyone with addiction I've ever met has at least one of those three criteria, if not all three.
And Maya, what do people get wrong about opioid addiction?
Well, mainly we get wrong by seeing it as a criminal issue. And I do not believe you can destigmatize addiction and criminalize it at the same time, because the whole point of criminalizing something and incarcerating people for possession is to stigmatize it, is to make it look like a crime, is to make people feel bad. And that really does a lot of harm. The other thing that we really get wrong is that the vast majority of opioid addiction does not begin with someone who actually has a prescription for the opioids that they are misusing. 80% of people who misuse prescription opioids do not have a prescription for them. They're getting it from friends, family, dealers. And conversely, most of the people who are pain patients never become addicted. So we've created the situation where basically we have cut the medical supply by 60% since 2011, and it has been replaced by a much, much, much more dangerous illegal supply, because we didn't provide help for people. We had a list of everybody that was at a pill mill because they had to give their name to get a prescription. And yet we just said, okay, we're just going to take the drugs away and that's going to solve pain and addiction. And we have made the problem twice as bad, at least.
And that's so interesting. You talk about where this starts, Katie, in your conversations with Chris. And Chris also dealt with addiction himself, right?
He did.
Yeah. What did he tell you about how it started in his family?
Well, it's interesting in the sense that their family, Chris talked to me a lot about generational trauma. The idea that he and his wife had addiction, and then their daughter, Stephanie, went through addiction. He really felt like that was part of the stigma that nobody talks about. That if you have someone in your family that is an addict, and you have those genes there, you know, just sort of being a family unit and how that gets passed down even when you try not to, right? And his wife struggled far after Chris did. And so that was something that really impacted their family.
And just to make sure, because if in case people missed it, he lost his wife first.
Yes, he lost his wife about 20 years ago and then his daughter a couple of years ago.
Maya, from your research and reporting, do we know who's more at risk to become addicted? I mean, when you talk about, is there an age group or where people are vulnerable, or is there, again, something we don't know about opioid addiction?
Sure. So the genetics is... Genetics are a huge risk factor. Having an outlying temperament as a child, which often reflects a predisposition to a mental illness, is also a serious risk factor. So basically, you could be a very bold child, you could be a very anxious child, you could be a very depressed child. But kids who stand out for some reason or another tend to feel isolated, and then they look for self-medication. And that is often how addictions begin. So trauma, mental illness, genetics, these all sort of combine, and there is an age factor as well. 90% of all addictions start in the teens or early 20s. And so if you can protect people at that time, their odds of getting addicted, even if they have to take opioids for pain or get some other kind of exposure, are just way, way lower.
I wonder why is that group so vulnerable? What is it?
Basically, yeah, sure. So there's both genetic and there's both cultural and biological factors. So during the late teens and early 20s is when 75% of all mental illness starts. Your brain is in a developmentally sensitive period at that point. You're kind of finishing the development of your cortex. And that is the area that kind of allows you to control yourself. And this is why actually a lot of people just stop being addicted when they get older. Because they now have the ability to put the brakes on that they didn't have previously. And a lot of people, bizarrely enough, recover without even getting treatment just because their brain has developed enough that they can just stop. Now, clearly, this is not everybody, but that is the age when you want to take risks and you want to impress girls or boys and you want to, you know, go out there and get yourself away from your family so you can, you know, start your life. So there's a lot of things that the brain is wanting you to do that put you at risk and also developmentally sensitive at that point.
Something that jumps out is what you said to me was genetics. And I wondered, like, if you know that this was a problem for your parents or for other relatives, what should you be?
It's interesting. So my dad was a Holocaust survivor and profoundly depressed. So you've got trauma and depression right there. That side of the family is Hungarian, and there is an enormously high prevalence of depression in Hungary. And depression is often a genetic pathway to addiction. And we have to be careful when we talk about genetics, because people just think, oh, you have some gene that makes you want drugs. No, you have a gene that makes you feel terrible, and then you seek to feel better and find drugs. And so a lot of times, addiction is much more explicable than we think it is, but we don't understand that different people are starting from different places emotionally and psychologically.
Katie, did Chris talk about that? Because he talked about his dealings with addiction and his wife, and were they worried about what their, you know, their daughter would have to deal with? Did he talk about that?
Yeah, Chris talked about it a little bit. And the first time I spoke with him, and his surviving daughter, Christina. He calls her Chrissy in the interview. And she really approaches this. Her whole life's work, just like her father now, is very centered on helping people with addiction. So she saw both of her parents and her sister struggle. And that struggle, it's not a one-time struggle. And I think, Maya, you have really, you know, put it so eloquently when you talk about this life. It's a journey, and sometimes you're going to be doing great and sometimes you're going to struggle, and there's this middle ground of it's not one state. And so Chris talked about how that was difficult on his family, and his daughter works counseling people who have addiction now, and that's really sort of where she found her life's work. And it's really interesting that they approach it differently now as a family, I think, than they did, and they were very worried about that.
The other thing that we heard in that conversation with Chris is the issue of law enforcement and his concern about how law enforcement treated him at the death of his daughter, the response. And we've talked about this a lot of times on the program and WLRN, but has training changed, Katie, on how law enforcement is supposed to go in, they see this situation, how they're supposed to deal with the surviving family member and how they're supposed to help them?
Yes. And part of that is going to be answered with resources, right? So you heard Chris say it himself of he did not feel respected when his daughter Stephanie overdosed. However, he understands that law enforcement is a huge, huge vital key to unlocking this. And I think you can compare it to like bedside manner at a doctor's office. The idea that there's a set of resources both professionals have, but how they're talking to you is going to vary from doctor to doctor or law enforcement officer to law enforcement officer. And now I can tell you the Broward County Sheriff's Office, they have a new piece of technology that they started using last year. It's pretty expensive. It's called the MX908. And it's the idea that they're trying to implement new resources at this stage of the pandemic. And, you know, given what we know about opioid use during the pandemic. And so this is a piece of tech they're bringing now. Like if they do a traffic stop and they want to test a substance in your car, this little device will tell them, oh, it's got cocaine or fentanyl or whatever is in that substance. It can tell them right away. So they're trying to get at this at more of the identification end. And then also, I think the community outreach piece of it is, at least for BSO, you know, they're still doing things like those medication disposal days where everybody brings their unused prescriptions to a park and gets rid of them instead of leaving them around in the house around the teenagers. So those things are definitely still happening too.
Again, we're talking with WLRN reporter Katie Swatowski-Munoz and Maya Solovitz. She's a freelance journalist and author who's been covering addiction for nearly three decades now. Her most recent book is titled Undoing Drugs, The Untold Story of Harm Reduction and the Future of Addiction. Maya, by the way, recently wrote a piece for Wired magazine about a state-level prescription drug database that's supposed to help authorities identify people who are at risk of misusing opioids. But it turns out that technology might actually be making the problem worse. You can find a link to that story and more of her work on our social media at WLRN Sundial. Maya, something else interesting about Chris's story, and I was thinking about is how we deal with people, how we help people, try to help people who are dealing with this addiction. And that word comes up, the phrase tough love, you know, it's often used. But in your book, you come at this from a very different approach. You don't think that works, do you?
No, well, we don't have evidence that it works. And if you just, if you just look at the definition of addiction, addiction is defined as compulsive behavior that occurs in the face of negative consequences. So negative consequences is a nice way of saying punishment, basically. So if punishment and being harsh to people stopped addiction, by definition, it wouldn't exist in the first place because you would stop once you had a consequence. So the whole idea is just completely backwards. What we're doing is shaming people and humiliating people and criminalizing people. And I really disagree with the idea that you can make law enforcement respectful of people that it is told to treat as criminals and their families. So I think we need an entirely different way of dealing with it. And the way that I've seen really works is something called harm reduction. And the idea there is that the focus of our policy should be on making sure people don't get hurt, not making sure people don't get high. And if you focus on the harm, then you can make policies that don't do enormous harm while trying to help.
And Maya, can I ask you, I'm curious because I feel like in South Florida, we're in such a dense region and so many people either have family members of their own that have experienced addiction or they know friends. It's hard not to know somebody in some stances that hasn't struggled with this. But I'm curious, you know, I feel like that's the message put out to family members is, you know, practice tough love. What have you seen or what do you recommend for people that, you know, maybe they want to find a treatment center for their loved one, but their loved one doesn't want to go? How do you handle something like that?
Well, basically what you have to do is ally yourself with the person who is addicted and meet them where they are. Find out what they want and what's important to them. And that's what harm reduction does. And it shows that, you know, I mean, most people with addiction don't get into recovery the first time they try. It is, you have to learn how to not use and you have to learn alternative coping skills. So we have to realize that people are going to change slowly. And that's what harm reduction does. It meets people where they are. And what you do as a family member is you try to find out, why does this person want the drug so desperately? Oftentimes it will be something like trauma or mental illness, or you know, people have a million different reasons why they feel like the drug is the thing they cannot live without and they will not have emotional comfort if they don't have it. What you want to do there is say, I want you to have emotional comfort. I want you to be safe. I want you to be okay, and help move them towards recovery in that way. So in harm reduction, one of the classic things is needle exchange. You give clean needles so that people don't get HIV or other potentially deadly bloodborne illnesses. And then when somebody takes the step of actually using a clean needle, they start to see, hey, wait a minute, I'm doing something for myself. I'm doing something more healthy. And these people here care about me regardless. Like, they think I'm a human being who deserves life regardless of my use. Maybe I am someone, maybe I deserve to do more than just sit around and do drugs. Maybe I can get better because look, I was able to make this small change. And this is how behavioral change in many different areas, diet, exercise, et cetera, tends to happen. And we need to sort of humanize addiction so that people understand that it's not about people wanting extra fun or having like a great deal of joy. And then we have to like force them and be mean to them to get them away from this thing that's so amazing. What, by the time you're really addicted, you're just trying to feel okay. And so,
because thinking about your story, I'm wondering, you know, what helped you? Was this the path that you took?
Well, it's interesting because I got into recovery in 1988. And this was really the peak of the drug war and people hated harm reduction. You know, like they didn't even want to give us bleach to clean needles because that would encourage children. You know, they were happy to let us die without that information that could save our lives. We have come a long way since then, but at the time, the only thing I was offered was an 28-day rehab based on 12 steps. And since I had no options, I just went for it. Now I look back at my story too, and that like in 1986, I actually did have an encounter with very, very early harm reduction where somebody taught me to use bleach to clean my needles. And then by the time I was ready to get help, I was not HIV positive. So it's kind of a both and situation. And I think the way that we help people recover has to recognize that addiction is just hugely, hugely varied. We just, there is no one true way.
Yeah. And you did mention the 12-step program, and Katie, Chris told, he believes in those.
He does. He was very supportive of the 12-step program. I know that has worked for a lot of people, but to Maya's point, it is individual, right? So someone can work a 12-step program once and it works for them. Someone can work a 12-step program 100 times and it's not what's going to help them out. But for Chris and his family, you know, he was very supportive of like, hey, wait, I see a lot of 12-step programs happening in South Florida. That gives me hope.
Maya, I don't... Go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, like, the problem with 12-step as a treatment for addiction is that 12-step is like a wonderful mutual aid society, but it is not treatment. If we actually want to believe that addiction is a disease, the 12 steps include making amends for the harm you've done, taking a moral inventory, trying to ask God to get rid of your defects of character. It is very, very moralistic. That doesn't mean it doesn't work for some people, but I think that since you can get it for free in church basements across the country in treatment that we pay for, we should pay for stuff that you don't get there and that gives people other options.
I wanted to, because of time, I didn't want to miss out on the opportunity, Maya, because we had mentioned in your Wired magazine piece, you talked about this state-level prescription drug database. And this is supposed to help doctors. My understanding from the reading is that it's supposed to help them know who's been going around shopping and who's been using. And then that way we kind of get a picture of, wait a minute, who might be abusing? And yet it turns out it's probably hurting people. But it, briefly, could you explain what this system is? Because it's used in Florida.
Sure, sure. So every state now has what's called a prescription drug monitoring program, which is a database that includes everybody's private information about what controlled substances are prescribed to them, whether it's testosterone or opioids or anti-anxiety medications like Valium. So this system is state by state, but they all interconnect so that they can check on you it across state lines. Now, this may have been a very useful thing when people were primarily getting their opioids from the medical system. But since we've really cut the medical system literally in half in terms of the amount being prescribed, what it's doing now is ending up targeting chronic pain patients. And what happened to the woman, one of the women in my story, she had endometriosis. She went to a hospital to get care for it. And after a couple of days of getting appropriate pain treatment with opioids for her, they suddenly looked at this thing and were like, oh my God, she must be an abuser, and like threw out of the hospital, literally. It turned out that she had to the algorithm, it looked like she was doctor shopping. In fact, she actually had very sick dogs who require large amounts of benzodiazepines. The veterinary prescriptions are still in there. And while they may be listed separately so that the doctor can see, you know, that that's going to a pet, it's not, the algorithm is kind of not clear.
Yeah.
So you don't know where it got the information.
I'm going to just say, because it's a long but really powerful piece, and we're going to share that on our social media to check it out so you understand how this system works. But in time, Maya, if I could ask you, you know, what is the message that you have for folks right now, for families who are dealing with addiction, just, you know, to help them at least begin the process to find help?
Sure. So treating people kindly and with respect and with dignity and recognizing that they have, that they're human, is the best way to help your loved one. They don't need more pain or more crisis or more drama. What they need is resources that will help them recover. And one of the best things parents can do is say, look, we're going to try to get you help and try this treatment center. And you know what? If it's terrible, we'll go somewhere else. Because if you realize that the point is not to like control you or take away your fun or make you feel bad, the point is to find a way for you to live comfortably in your own skin. Yeah. Then the family and the person can work together to find what works and to discard, because there's just an awful lot of harmful treatment out there. And there's one thing that I would be remiss if I didn't say. We have two medications that cut the death rate from opioid addiction by 50% or more. They are buprenorphine and methadone. Buprenorphine is also known as Suboxone. They only work if you stay on them long term, but they do reduce your risk of dying dramatically. And so a lot of people in some 12-step programs really oppose these medications, but they don't make people high all the time.
Right.
And it's really important to save lives.
My understanding, too, that's maintenance treatment. I wanted to just to finish up real quickly, Katie. Lawmakers know this problem is getting worse, but is there anything, any conversation with the legislative session coming up on dealing with this?
Yeah, you're starting to see some bills get filed already, some early bills about this. I think you're going to see that lawmakers suddenly have pots of money to look at from the lawsuits with opioid manufacturers like Purdue Pharma. And so where Florida designates chunks of that money is going to come into play. Attorney General Ashley Moody has said that the state will use that money to bolster its drug treatment efforts. What that looks like is still yet to pan out. But I would be remiss if I didn't say that the Times and the Herald Bureau in Tallahassee has been doing some really great reporting from ground zero of the legislature about what lawmakers are thinking going into January. Some Republicans and, you know, Senate President Wilton Simpson looking at ways that maybe they're not spending too much, but they're trying to be more practical and effective. So those are that's sort of the tone going into the session.
WLRN reporter Katie Switalski-Munoz. Check out her reporting on this story at WLRN.org. I also want to thank Maya Solovitz. She's a freelance journalist, author of the book Undoing Drugs, The Untold Story of Harm Reduction and the Future of Addiction. Katie, Maya, thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Lewis.
Well, still to come, a Key West artist finally gets the appreciation and respect that she deserves decades later. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Lewis Hernandez. In the 1960s, Lily Pulitzer changed fashion with simple shift dresses in wild, whimsical prints. A lot of those prints even incorporated her name. Now, those prints were actually the work of someone else, an artist in Key West whose name was never publicly credited until now. WLRN's Nancy Klinginer tells us this story.
In 2007, a lawyer from St. Louis named Becky Smith made a one-day trip to Key West. She was looking for vintage Lilly Pulitzer fabrics to reupholster a chair. She'd heard you could find them in Key West, because a company here called Key West Handprint Fabrics had produced most of the original fabrics for Lilly Pulitzer in the 1960s and 70s. So Smith tracked down a woman named Martha DePue, who'd worked there in the art department.
And she said, well, you don't want to talk to me. You want to talk to my mom, because my mom actually created the look. And so I was like, well, I would love to be able to meet your mom. And she goes, yeah, she lives down the street. Let's go visit her. We drove over to Susie's house and literally a peacock, I think, greeted us at the door along with a couple of roosters. And there was Susie, you know, sitting underneath this huge banyan tree.
Susie Zuzek told Smith about how her textile designs for the fabric company in Key West were the foundation of the Lilly Pulitzer look.
You know, quite frankly, I really didn't believe it because I had worn Lilly Pulitzer my whole life and I'd really never heard of them.
As Smith started digging into the story, she learned thousands of Susie Zuzek's original textile designs were still in Key West, stored under the floorboards of an old building. Her research led her to the Library of Congress, looking through the cards that recorded the copyrights on the designs.
It was 100, 200, 300, 500, 600, 700, 900, 1,000, 1,200, 1,500 designs listed Susie Zuzek as the artist.
That moment in the card catalog at the Library of Congress is when Smith decided to make saving Zuzek's work and getting it recognized her mission.
When you realize that it was just really one woman who created all of these designs, you know, really of my childhood, I was like, wow, why don't we know this?
Smith got some investors together and bought the Key West Handprint Archive. And now the Cooper Hewitt Museum in New York has a show highlighting Zuzek's work. That show and a new coffee table book are finally telling the world. The Lilly Pulitzer prints that captured the imaginations of Jackie Kennedy and countless others were the work of Susie Zuzek in Key West.
Everything from cabbages to Roman coins and scrimshaw and weather vanes and seaweed and pirate ships and then the animal prints, which were wonderful and unexpected because she would play with scale.
Susan Brown is a curator at the Cooper Hewitt. She put together the show and wrote an essay for the book. She says Zuzek's designs go way beyond the florals associated with a Lilly Pulitzer look.
So you'd have like a cheetah that was completely dwarfed by a daylily, or she would kind of camouflage the animals within the pattern so that you wouldn't see them at first or wouldn't see them from a distance, but then they would kind of materialize before your eyes.
Zuzek trained at the Pratt Institute and worked in design in New York. Then she married a Key Wester and moved to the island in the mid-50s. She went to work designing textiles for Key West Handprint Fabrics in 1961. Lee Hooten arrived in Key West after art school in Philadelphia to intern at the fabric company. At a community garden next to a school playground, she remembers how the explosion of colors and the different flowers and animals in Key West affected her, and imagines how Zuzek must have experienced that too.
It's like Dr. Seuss world when you first get down here. Everything is so different than the Northeast.
The animals especially were what made Zuzek's designs different. She grew up on a farm in upstate New York and surrounded herself with animals all her life.
There was a goat, there were chickens, there were peacocks, there was a rooster that would sleep in a puddle,
we had a monkey,
cats, dogs. It was just a menagerie. And that menagerie and that life that she created there was all translated into her work.
Martha DePue says her mother was an introvert who didn't really take direction about what to draw.
I mean, you can see here, I mean, I suspect that when she was designing this, that she was having a fantasy. I mean, look at cats with hats and bows and, you know, the duck with a little hat. And I think she amused herself that way. That was her interior life, I believe.
Meanwhile, Lilly Pulitzer was a Palm Beach socialite in the early 60s. She started making simple dresses to wear while selling orange juice from a stand in Palm Beach. After she saw the Key West fabrics, she ordered some for her dresses, and both her business and the fabric company from Key West took off. Lilly Pulitzer's shift dresses freed women from girdles and garters and provided the perfect platform for Zuzek's wild imagination. Susan Brown from the Cooper Hewitt says wearing them was an irreverent, tongue-in-cheek statement just right for the early 60s.
The colors were a little garish, the patterns were a little loud. The whole thing was rebellious, but in a way that was fun and happy.
Lilly Pulitzer's name was on the business, and she had the social connections. And Brown says it's not unusual for the designers of textiles to go without credit.
Fashion designers are notoriously secretive because they want to protect their sources. And particularly in a case like this, where the prints were like so central to the Lilly Pulitzer look. There are so many brilliant people, especially women, who've been written out of the history of design.
DePue says she thinks seeing someone else get credit for her work must have bothered her mother, but she only remembers one incident after a fashion spread appeared in a glossy magazine. The story made no mention of Key West Handprint Fabrics or Zuzek.
There was a line that said something to the effect of, Lily's brush still wet from the vibrant colors. And when my mother brought, I mean, she didn't talk for about 2 weeks. She was so upset.
Susie Zuzek retired from Key West Handprint Fabrics in 1985. She kept making art, sculptures, paintings, and tile work. She died in 2011. Two exhibits in Key West have celebrated her art. But her influence on American fashion remained largely unknown until Becky Smith, the lawyer from St. Louis, wanted to reupholster a chair.
And again, that was WLRN's Keys reporter Nancy Klinginer. The exhibit, Susie Zuzak for Lily Pulitzer, is up at the Cooper Hewitt Museum in New York City until January 2nd. You can see some of Susie Zuzak's original designs and the video the Cooper Hewitt Museum made about her work on her social media at WLRN Sundial. And that's our program for this Tuesday, October 19th. Now, we don't have a show tomorrow. Tomorrow is the Miami-Dade County School Board meeting, but we're back Thursday live, and we're going to be talking about a new exhibit that's looking at misinformation during this pandemic. Also, the misinformation at the beginning of the AIDS crisis back in the 80s. It looks at the scientifically inaccurate ideas and cures that have shaped how the society views AIDS today. And we're going to learn about that history and its parallels to the misinformation that's being spread today about COVID-19. Again, that's coming up on Thursday's live program. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thank you so much for listening. Stay safe. Be good to each other. The program is made possible in part by support from Miami Cancer Institute.
WLRN Public Media.